This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeline Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, a touch of Faust, switching the goals on your protagonist and when this works.
So, motivations in books and in storytelling in general are obviously important, but, and I've spoken on this before, so I'm sorry if anyone has just been binge listening to Dissecting Dragons and just heard me say this. I hope you haven't, but I usually find that there are three major motivations which are seen in a character's story arc. And the first is the innocent motivation, which is usually something idealistic or something very, very simple. Then there's the selfish motivation, which is driven by your own internal desire for something. And the third is the righteous motivation, which is usually driven by something greater than you as an individual. So if I try and find an example of this, we start off in a story arc. Someone wants to go on an adventure. They've always wanted adventure their entire life. That's the innocent motivation. Second motivation is something gets taken away from them, or their village gets attacked and they get forced to go out onto this quest that they don't really want, that they actually don't really want to do. And they're motivated by a desire to get the thing which was stolen back, or to get revenge or justice. And the third motivation is the one at the end, and they have to overcome the second motivation in order to get to the third, which is usually like the second crisis or the third crisis. And that is the motivation which is, okay, it's more than my life at stake. I'm now doing this to save everybody in the universe. So those are the three kind of motivations we see. That's a pattern that is quite similar in a lot of fiction. So what we're talking about today isn't just the changing of motivations. It's when the direction completely turns its head as well, and it's no longer just about the progression of motivation. It's about it doing a 180.
And I think I'll explain the title a little bit. If you're not familiar with medieval German folk tales, then you probably won't know what Faust is, but that's basically where it comes from. Probably one of the oldest examples anyway of Faust is Christopher Marlowe's Dr. Faustus, but the one that I always come back to is Goethe's Faust, which is written in, you know, 16th century German, and I just really enjoy it, and I can't really say why I enjoy it, except that I quite like the way Goethe turns a phrase. because Faust is not a great character. He's, to give you a snapshot of the story, he is fed up of his life as it is. He wants a life less ordinary. And what he wants to know, that there's things about the universe he wants to know. He wants intellectual pursuits. Ideally, he would like intellectual pursuits that allow him money and things that allow him to do what he wants to do. But the big thing that he really wants is the love of this pure and innocent, beautiful girl called Gretchen. So he makes a deal with a demon called Mephistopheles. I think you can see that this is not actually going to end very well.
Not if there's a character called Mephistopheles.
Mephistopheles, not Mr. Mephistopheles the cat. Just when you think you're going somewhere, Madeline interrupts you with some T.S. Eliot. Going back to Goethe. He makes a deal, and the deal is he gets 24 years, effectively. So 1 year for every hour of the day. And Gretchen does come to love him. And he gets Gretchen, and when he gets her, he finds out he doesn't actually really want her. What he really wants is somebody else. Aside from the fact that he's made this really, really stupid bargain, as in it's like stupider than most credit card type credit card rates, is the fact that he sold his soul for something he doesn't really want anymore. He's got it, but he's got it not through winning her affection or earning her love And it's an empty victory. It's useless to him. You don't need to go much further than that. Faust is also about, you know, if you look at the broad folk tale and Christopher Marlowe's play as well, Faust is also about compromising your moral integrity for a comparatively small gain. But Goethe's Faust is very much about achieving what you think you want, only to discover that it isn't what you want. Now, to go completely in the opposite direction to Goethe and Faust, a really, really good example of this is a Pixar film called Cars. Have you seen that one?
Yeah.
You have the car, Lightning, who wants to win. Who wants to win the race. He's quite arrogant at the beginning of the film. Just, you know, he's a car. Fair enough. Yeah, I think it's speculative enough so that I can talk about this. There's no demons, but
yeah,
he's a car. He's a conscious cars. Car. He wants to win, and because he's arrogant and there are various other character aspects, he fails. He finds himself in an out-of-the-way town where he falls in love with a beautiful car called Porsche. Guess what kind of car she is?
I can't think.
But he also makes friends with a truck called Dusty, I think it is.
And, Hillbilly.
Yeah, and various other vehicles. And there's one that he rather looks down on, and the others don't like to, you know, he seems a bit of an outcast. And he finds out that this is actually the Derby winner, and he's just been completely forgotten because this old car has had no friends. He just focused solely on the goal. Anyway, Lightning's sort of hiding out from the fame and the infamy of having failed, the whole shame of the thing, and he gets found out, someone reports him, and they cart him back to do the Derby, and he wins, but it's empty, it's just dust and ashes because his friends aren't there to see him.
Yeah.
So it is basically a Pyrrhic victory, you know, a completely empty victory. The cost of it, him not having any friends around, is far more than he was actually willing to pay, even though he didn't understand it at the time. I can't believe I'm going this in depth with a Pixar film, but it's a really good example. So we're going to look at some other examples and how, you know, sometimes changes within the character themselves can promote some of the best shifting motivations and goals for a story.
Yeah. Now, I think that Pixar actually is something that Pixar and DreamWorks are actually two creators of fiction that do actually really often have main characters whose direction changes rapidly, usually near the end. And I think it's because they have this kind of theme whereby they say what you want isn't actually what you need.
Yeah.
And ultimately you'll get what you need, not what you want. Now, Toy Story is another good example of that, especially the last one. You know, what they want is they want Andy to play with them. They want Andy to take them with him. And what they actually need is they need to be passed on to someone younger.
Yeah.
Who is going to play with them. Because ultimately that's the reality of what's going to happen. And their motivations, you know, at the end, it changes that they want to get back to Andy, then they want to survive, then they let go and they accept that this is the end of their relationship with Andy, but it's not the end of their relationship with children. A similar feel is Up, which is a movie which wrecked me. Like, I could never watch it again.
Is it the prologue?
Yeah, it hurt. It really, really hurts. And again, it's this man, his entire motivation at the beginning is he wants to get there, and he wants to get there because he feels like he's kind of failed his wife in some way. And ultimately, he gives up everything. He gives up his house. He gives it all up for something which is totally selfless. And he gets a new family, which was far beyond what his motivation was. He wanted to seclude himself from the rest of the world because he wanted to hold on to the past.
Yeah.
And then in the end, he had to do the exact opposite.
Yeah, absolutely. Another Pixar DreamWorks one, which is a pretty good example, is Shrek, actually. Because Shrek thinks he wants to be left alone. Fiona thinks she wants to get rid of the curse and not keep turning into an ogre.
Yep.
And by the end of the film, Shrek has discovered that actually he wants to be with Fiona, and Fiona has discovered that, well, actually she wants to be with Shrek, but in order for that to be possible, she needs to let go of being a princess, not let go of being an ogre.
Yeah.
So complete 180 with the motivations. And obviously you have the donkey there as well. In Shrek's case, it's a case of, no, I'm not going to let you be on your own. I need a friend. I've decided you're going to be my friend. And it's great. It's a lovely commentary on friendship and about how going out, you know, as a fairly young person saying, this is what I want in a romantic partner, and then discovering that actually, no, it isn't what you want at all.
No.
In Fiona's case, it's like, no, you don't want the prince who doesn't know anything about you and would hate you if you're an ogre.
Yeah.
There's no way you could love him or he could love you. And it's staring you in the face.
I mean, Fiona, it's not even just that it's not that she thinks she wants the prince. It's that she thinks she wants to be a princess more than she wants to be happy.
Yeah.
And that's obviously not the case.
No, not at all. A good example of oddly similar plotline. I'm jumping back and forth between adult and children's genres here, but there's Fox Mask by Juliet Marillier, and the main character, Creda, thinks that she really wants to be with Thorvald. Thorvald's actually very, very selfish, and he's on a mission to find his father. Creda stows away on the ship, and they all get basically shipwrecked on an island with some very, very peculiar people. And Creda finds out that who she thought she should be with and who she thought she wanted to spend her life with actually wasn't the right person for her at all. And the bitter irony for Thorvald in this is he discovers that actually he didn't really need to find his father. What he really wanted was Creda all along, just as she discovered she wants somebody else. But, you know, that really is kind of his own fault by that point.
Yeah.
But it is all a depiction of growing up and discovering the difference between what you think you want and what you actually need, and choosing a partner, yeah, I suppose, who brings out the best in you, or choosing several partners.
We're going to draw on a book that Jules has read and I haven't yet. I will very soon. I've been badgered by all from all sort of angles about it now, and that I've read the first one, and A Court of Thorns and Roses.
Yeah.
By Sarah J. Maas, and then there's A Court of Mist and Fury. Now, again, spoiler alert, Feyre is not going to end up with Tamlin the Tool, as he's commonly being called now on my dash. But looking just at the first book itself, already we see Feyre's motivations rapidly changes. And we're going to talk, and this is again something we're going to talk about, fairy tales, and the motivations in that. But Feyre at the beginning doesn't actually want to, but feels like she needs to take care of her family. And then she wants her freedom so that she can take care of her family. And then when she realises she doesn't actually have to take care of her family anymore, she wants Tamlin. But then... Jules, I'll let you explain better.
Yeah.
You actually read the books.
What it comes down to is, in The Court of Thorns and Roses, at the end, Feyre literally goes into hell to get Tamlin back. Because because of the very harsh life she's led, she's not really very in touch with her feelings. She doesn't realise she's fallen in love with him.
Yeah.
The problem arises at the beginning of A Court of Mist and Fury is the fact that the person who goes into hell to fetch her, the person she's in love with, is not the same person who comes out. She has literally been physically changed. She's died and come back as a fae.
Yeah.
And Tamlin was in love with the human girl and is refusing to accept that Feyre, that the fae being that came out of hell with him, is actually a different person with different needs, and keeps trying to address the needs of the girl she used to be before she went through all this horrible trauma. And it really is really quite graphic. She essentially gets tortured to death. She's a different person after that, as you would be. He's a different person after everything he's endured, but he just wants to almost crystallise it in amber and say none of it happened and just go back to being the way everything was before. Feyre wants to address it, which is actually a much more healthy way of dealing with everything. But because Tamlin won't meet her halfway, she's being trapped into being someone she's not anymore. And also there's other things. There's aspects where he's trying to control her. He's not happy with her being an equal part in the relationship. Before, she was human, so she was physically weaker. She had less endurance. She was going to die someday. She was going to age. aside from all of those things, she now has abilities, and he won't even tell her she has them, let alone train her how to use them. She ends up shut up in the house because effectively he believes that, or at least he tells her he believes, that she could be used against him, so she can't leave. And yet, really, the sensible approach would be, well, yes, potentially you could be used against me, so let's teach you how to use your abilities and how to defend yourself.
Yeah.
It's a very, very selfish thing, as in, I love you, therefore no one else can come anywhere near you. And it would have killed her.
Now, I think this is, again, something we should look at. Not Feyre's change of motivations, but Tamlin's as well.
Yeah.
Because Tamlin, at the beginning, did everything he did in order to help his court and to get his powers back. That was what his motivation was. Then his motivation did a complete 180.
Yeah.
Because he gave it all up, because he wanted Feyre not to have to go through that. So he let her go. Even though they still had a couple of days, he could have still waited for her to say, I love you, and to break the curse. He was worried about her, he let her go. So that's a moment of his motivations completely changing. And now his motivations have changed again, because he's got his powers back, which is what he initially wanted. But actually, what he really wants is, he wants Feyre back. He wants the Feyre he knew back. And he isn't really prepared to deal with the Feyre she has become in the fallout of what she chose to do, which is something he didn't really want her to do. He didn't want her to suffer the way she did. I mean, he probably could have helped a little bit more. It wasn't very helpful. But he didn't really want any of that. And so he's dealing with the fallout of getting what he initially wanted, but not actually what he then wanted. And he's never going to get that back. He just can't.
Yeah. It's not that he's a bad person. He's someone suffering from what's effectively post-traumatic stress disorder, if you can have that after being in a fairy hell, which I'm presuming you can. But he's quite selfish, generally. Before, where you see him doing an awful lot for her, what does he really do that isn't just a bit of general kindness and throwing some money at her?
Yeah.
He's not giving a lot of his time.
No.
And time is a lot more precious than money, because nobody's making any more time.
No.
Ultimately, it's the one commodity that you can't get it back. So she needed his time, not, to be bought another painting set after the whole hell trip. So he doesn't come off being compared very favourably, and it's his inability to change. It's the fact that he's become somebody who's got his powers back, and he kind of likes the power for its own sake, and he's not willing to be either the second, the beta in a relationship, or to be part of an equal partnership, which is what she wants.
Yeah.
And it's not wrong to want that.
No, it's not wrong.
That's worth saying, because quite a lot of young adult romances do seem to say there's one person who's in charge and one person who isn't. You don't get very many depictions where it's a case of, well, actually, I don't really want you to risk yourself, but I respect your decisions. And you know what? It is your life. I don't like that you're going to do this, but I understand your reasoning.
Yeah. Anyway, we're getting on topic. This is now just turning into an episode about Court of Thorns and Roses.
Well, no, I mean, it is quite important, because it shows that the motivations have shifted.
Yes.
Obviously, yeah. Completely. So one book has gone one way, and then this is partly why I didn't want to read A Court of Mist and Fury, was it felt like it was doing a complete 180 and undoing the first book. And it's not a case of that at all. It's very well done. Feyre has actually achieved everything she set out to achieve, and more. And it is a Pyrrhic victory, because the cost was so high that it almost wasn't worth it to her personally to achieve it.
Yeah, she gave a lot more of her soul to achieve something for someone else, to be honest.
I mean, another really good example, and I've only just realised, being a bit slow, but it is kind of a retelling of Faust, is Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell by Suzanne Clarke.
Ah, yes!
Because at the beginning you have Jonathan Strange, who desperately wants, I can't remember the girl's name, but he desperately wants a particular girl to marry him. And she does love him, but she thinks he needs an occupation. So in order to win her over, he has to have an occupation. He turns out to be good at magic, so he becomes a magician. And then that starts to take him over to the point where, even though he's married the woman he wants, she is very secondary to everything else in his magical life. Yeah. And it's the same with Mr. Norrell. He wants magic to be respectable and to actually be practiced, not just talked about in the pub once a month.
Yeah. And then he gets what he wants. Yeah.
He's very, very threatened by it. So it's a really good achievement, an amazing achievement, in fact, to get both characters with a complete 180 on their goals in that book. And yeah, as I said, you know, he obviously doesn't truck with demons or anything, but it is sort of a retelling of Faust.
It is. Instead of demons, they're fairies, which might as well be demons, to be honest.
They are very demonic fairies.
But yeah, and again, I've not read the novel. I only know the series. But I agree that they almost swap places in what they're doing, in that Mr. Norrell loves magic and it's what he's all about. And then in the end, he doesn't really want anyone else to kind of get their hands on it, I guess, in some ways. Whereas Jonathan Strange doesn't really care about magic to begin with. He's just kind of doing it. And then by the end, he's possessed by it. And he's possessed by, again, in the series, he's possessed by it. And ultimately, he loses his wife because of it. And then kind of loses his sanity because of it. And everything he wanted at the beginning, the whole reason he got into magic for her, so that they could start a family, so that he could live with her, is ultimately lost.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, again, a complete shift in goals.
Yeah.
And it is actually a theme, usually with the secondary characters in fairy tales, as we mentioned with A Court of Thorns and Roses. But, I mean, for example, Beauty and the Beast, you've got the Beast who wants the curse broken. But yeah, when he does actually fall in love with somebody, he realises he wants her happiness more than he wants the curse broken. I mean, I do feel sorry for all his magical servants, but but he lets her go because her happiness and her freedom matters more. So again, it's a shift in goals. Because he doesn't start off wanting to be in love with anybody or wanting a wife as such, depending on which version you're reading. He just wants the curse broken. She's a means to an end.
She is. I'm trying to think of other fairy tales which have got a similar kind of turnaround. I can't think off the top of my head.
It's very rarely the main character in a fairy tale that gets the complete goal shift, the paradigm shift.
I can't think of... it's not really a shift, but Dr. Octopus in the Spider-Man movie with Tobey Maguire, is that his name?
Yeah.
Tobey Maguire? In that movie, Dr. Octavius wanted to create something good, and he was being good about it. Then he ultimately miscalculated, his wife was killed, and he got possessed by the electronic arms that were attached to his back. Awkward. So he then robs banks and does all sorts of horrible things in trying to get it working again. And his initial motivation for this, it wasn't actually to... I mean, he was blinded by his own hubris, but it was a good intention. He had very good intentions for what he was trying to do. His secondary motivation then is the selfish one. He wants it to work, and not for other people's sake, but for his own sake, even though it's not going to work, even though it's very, very dangerous. And by the end, he gives up his life, and he gives up his experiment and all of his work in order for the better good. So this is a case of his motivation at the beginning was to create this amazing thing and to make everybody's lives better. His motivation at the end is to destroy this thing and destroy himself, because he can't be with his wife and yeah, he sacrifices himself. So that is a complete turnaround, because it went from wanting to create something to desperately wanting to destroy it. Yeah. And that's something that usually you see in heroic arcs. It's not something... You don't very often get villains who have a turnaround in their motivations. just because they don't, it doesn't often happen, but the point of a villain is that their motivation actually tends to remain the same throughout and intensifies, which ultimately leads to their downfall because they're incapable of growing and changing, which is the strength that the hero has against them.
That's just made me think of, have you seen Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog?
Yes, yes.
Clearly he's supposed to, in theory, be the villain, but he is the main character, and he thinks what he wants is to be accepted by Bad Horse, who is actually a horse. I'm sorry, that still makes me laugh now. And it's Neil Patrick Harris. It's absolutely brilliant. If you haven't seen it, look it up. It's absolutely brilliant. But it's quite poignant as well, in true Joss Whedon style, because he gets everything he wants at the end. He gets accepted. He's considered a supervillain. He gets a seat at the table. But the cost has been the girl he loves life. Yeah. And it's a completely empty... It's just dust and ashes. The whole thing is just meaningless because he accidentally killed the wrong person.
Yeah. And the person he was against doesn't care.
No.
Nathan Fillion.
No, he's the supposed hero is very heroic in the sort of Greek hero sense where he's entirely self-centered.
Yeah.
Not a particularly nice character.
No. And ultimately, actually, again, his motivations for being a villain were all about the fact that he didn't like this hero character, because the hero was actually a bully.
Yeah, it's all about his own search for personal significance, I think.
Yeah, but when he was talking to the female character, Felicia Day, I'm just going to call him by the actor's name, it showed evidence of compassion. And it's not like he wanted to be diabolically, you know, ruin everybody's lives. He actually kind of wanted to better people's lives, and he appreciated her for wanting to better people's lives.
Yeah, they wanted to go about it in different ways, but that actually their moral goals were in line with each other.
Yeah.
Whereas she was sort of a novelty to Captain Hammer. Is Captain Hammer, I think.
Hammer, yeah.
But it's very noticeable. I mean, you get the clue right at the beginning where he says it's not a death ray, it's a freeze ray. And he says it because a death ray is like so last year. But actually, if you think about it, a freeze ray is reversible.
Yeah.
Whereas a death ray just goes one way, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So it's like he's not completely wedded to villainy.
No. What he actually wants is recognition. And what he actually wants, above all, is recognition from this girl that he really likes. And he doesn't get it.
No. But that's a funny thing. He probably could have had it.
Yeah. And this leads us on to Aristotle. I think it is Aristotle. Yeah, it's Aristotle's... sorry, what?
I was going to say, how many other shows can you listen to and go from Pixar to Aristotle?
Plenty, mate. It's Aristotle's theory of tragedies, his formula for Greek tragedies. I'm pretty sure it's Aristotle.
Yeah, I think you're probably right.
And Aristotle had a formula for Greek tragedies, which was that it would start with a clue of what's going to happen. Sorry, hang on. I've got it written down here. I'm just trying to find it. It would start with a clue of what was going to happen, a hint toward the hubris. Then you'd get the main character. Main character has been raised on high. I'm gonna quote Antigone here, for it, just because it's the one I've read most recently. So Antigone, it starts off at the beginning. There's been this battle. Antigone's two brothers have been killed. For those who aren't well versed in Greek tragedy, Antigone and the two brothers are the sons and daughter of Oedipus and his mother. So, yeah. And Oedipus obviously came upon his mother hanging herself, stabbed himself in the eyes, and then died. So, not a great, you know, family reunion there. Then the two brothers agreed that they would split the rule between them, and... unfortunately what happened was that when the other brother came in saying, right, it's my turn to rule, the first one said, nope, they went to war, both of them murdered each other.
Yeah. Man hands on misery to man.
Yeah. Um, And then, yeah, so that's where it goes. And then at that point, I think it's King Creon takes the throne with his son Haemon, who's in love with Antigone. So the rules of tragedy go clues, high point, where the character reaches their high point. Everyone else appreciates them. So we've got King Creon. He's been crowned. Everyone is, you know, listening to what he's saying. And then it's the begins to fall. And it's usually a small thing whereby, unlike most formulas that we see nowadays, the formula for Greek tragedy is that you actually tend to have the downfall happens right at the beginning. Right at the beginning, in that they make one mistake, and that is the big mistake in the height of their power, whereas usually we do it the other way around. So it begins to fall, they see their mistake, then they die, obviously, and then there's a relief at the end, which is just how the rules of tragedy work. I was making a point with this, but I completely forgot what it is.
I think Shakespeare adheres to those rules.
It is. I mean, these are the rules of tragedy. And it was about the changing of motivations. And in this case, Greek tragedy is quite interesting because the change of motivations in Greek tragedy, usually when you have a change of motivations, it ultimately leads to something better coming of it. Whereas in Greek tragedy, the character has this hubris or whatever that they fall victim of. And that's it. Everything goes downhill from there. And right at the end, they realize their mistake. They have a change of motivation. And by then it's too late.
Yes.
And then they die.
That's the thing with tragedy, is the recognition and reversal happens when the reversal couldn't do anything to change the outcome.
Yeah.
Whereas if it's a comedy, it doesn't necessarily make you laugh, but the recognition and reversal happens early enough that the course of events can still be diverted.
Yeah. So, that's actually how the two are defined. So, yeah, going back to Antigone, King Creon has ordered that neither of the body, the body of the previous king is buried, but the other body, who's the traitor, is left to rot. Antigone refuses to allow this because that's great dishonor on her brother, so she goes and she buries him. Creon sentences her to repent what she's done. She refuses. He sentences her to die, where they bury her alive in a mountain, which I think is a bit harsh. Haemon, Creon's son, obviously, is not happy about this. Goes and tries to save Antigone. He goes in, he breaks into the mountain to save her, and she's already hanged herself, I think. And so he commits suicide, and Creon just goes, oh, and kind of is depressed from then on. And that's the, and the end is, yeah, I probably maybe should not have dishonored whoever they, you know, you should never leave a body out because it's dishonor, no matter whether they were our enemies or not. It was a violation against the gods, and that's why this happened. So the relief happened, but it was too late.
They're very much like King Lear realizing that perhaps he shouldn't have had that mad sort of outburst at the beginning where he exiled the one good daughter right at the end, just as everybody's literally dying around them, and they're next.
Yeah.
In fact, if you want a Shakespeare play for body count, King Lear's up there with the best of them.
It's, that and Hamlet.
Yeah.
It's a joke I always have with people. It's just, they're like, someone once said, you can have a sequel to everything. I'm like, you'd be hard-pressed to have a sequel for Hamlet. They all die. The one guy who survives tries to kill himself.
I was going to say, wouldn't it be called Rosencrantz and Guildenstern? That would be it. Actually, do both of them survive? I can't remember.
No, they all of them die.
Everybody
dies. Single one of them, except for Horatio.
Ah, that's
Horatio's
because
the only one who lives.
That's because he's still got something to learn about his philosophy, isn't it?
Yeah. Well done, Horatio.
Okay, slightly more modern examples, if we can come up with some.
What you're saying, Antigone isn't modern enough for you?
Well, it is a couple of thousand years old. Yeah, one which very much takes in the change in the way the character thinks and feels is The Host. however you feel about Stephanie Meyer, it's done quite well in that particular book, which is her science fiction body snatchers type thing. You end up with two people occupying the same body. One of them is Melanie. It was her body originally. And the other one is Wanderer, who is the small silvery soul. They call themselves souls, who was inserted into her head when Melanie was caught. Those two, Melanie won't just fade away like everyone else does when they have a soul inserted into their head. So Wanderer is constantly at war within herself against Melanie. Mm-hmm. And it's only when somebody else is trying to find out what's going on, as in really, really prying, you kind of really hate this character and want to hit them. You really do. It's the Seeker. It forces the two of them into an uneasy alliance until they actually become friends. So Wanderer's goal at the beginning is just to live a life on Earth, because they've lived in various different planets. Wanderer's been at least 8 different other species in her lifetime. She's hundreds of thousands of years old.
Yeah.
Melanie just wants to protect her boyfriend and her little brother. And it ends up, I mean, everything is pretty horrible for Wanderer. Ultimately, she wants the body to herself. Melanie wants her body back. Those two desires cannot coexist together. But they end up becoming friends by the end of the book, where Melanie almost doesn't want to let Wanderer go, because Wanderer realises that she can't stay being a parasite and still love all the people that she loves. So what she wants at the beginning of the book has so completely changed by the end of it. It's a case of, at the beginning, she wants Melanie to go, to disappear, basically to die. Whereas at the end of the book, she wants to die herself so that Melanie can have her body back, because there just isn't enough space for both of them. She doesn't want to be just put in somebody else, because she's worried she'd be taking somebody else's life away from them.
Yeah, because she's been so affected by her.
Yeah, she's become human. She's, you know, joined. She has joined the human condition, and they have not given her an easy ride of it. I wouldn't say she's quite tortured, but she gets beaten up quite a lot for being an infected human, a soul. But she's willing to die for the humans that she loves. At the end of the book, it is one that's worth reading. It's not sparkly vampires, this, at all. There's some melodrama, but there would be, because that's how Stephanie Meyer writes. But it is there's nothing wrong with a bit of melodrama. It's just got to be in the right place. I think it's a really interesting character journey for this one particular character, who would otherwise be quite passive, but isn't, because of her character arc and what she has to do.
And yeah, it's an example. And I think that I don't know how much time we have left.
Well, just a few minutes.
In which case, this would probably be my last little point. But I think very often, when the motivation has shifted in such a drastic manner, it is almost always due to the introduction of a character who the main character did not anticipate.
Yeah. There's something that's caused the fundamental shift.
Yeah, and more often than not, what happens is that the two exchange the qualities that make them with this other person. So one becomes less uptight, one becomes more sort of guarded, if that makes sense.
Kind of like the classic buddy cop films.
Yes. Absolutely.
Sorry, I'm thinking of Lethal Weapon.
Yeah.
That's actually a really good example, because both of them have a complete goal shift, 180. I can't remember the names of the characters, but one of them wants a more exciting life, the other one just basically has a death wish because he's alone. And then by the end of the film, and I know this isn't speculative fiction, so I am sorry, at the end of the film, the guy who wanted a more exciting life appreciates his family, and the guy who had a death wish doesn't want to die anymore because he's got a friend and he's not alone anymore. And it's actually really kind of cute. They start off hating each other.
So, yeah. So I think that's what we can take away, is that you can very, very well do an excellent story where the character's motivation completely changes, but there has to be a jolly good reason for it to have done that.
Yeah.
And usually the reason tends to be because of someone's been introduced that this first character was just not anticipating.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the writing tricks that if you can pull it off in your story, it's brilliant. It's one of the best story lines, I think, that you can actually have. But it's that complete dust and ashes moment when you achieve everything you set out to achieve at the end. But it's very difficult to do it without it being contrived.
Yeah. But there we go. And on that note, I think we'll call it.
Yeah. So, just a quick recap. We've looked at the idea of a Pyrrhic victory. We've looked at Faust and how a complete 180-degree goal shift can affect a storyline. As Madeline's pointed out, it's usually to do with the introduction of another character, something that the main character didn't see coming, and how this dates back to sort of fairy tales and old folk tales.
And we looked at Aristotle.
Not literally. We looked at Aristotle. Seriously. We looked at things like A Court of Thorns and Roses and the shift over between A Court of Thorns and Roses and A Court of Mist and Fury by Sarah J. Maas. We looked at Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, which does it really well.
And we looked at The Host.
So, if anyone has any thoughts on shifting protagonist's goals and Pyrrhic victory?
And if you have any examples where it's not because of the introduction of another character, please do let us know. We'd be very interested to find out.
Yeah, we would.
On that note, we'll call it, and we'll see you guys next week.
Thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.